everyone. I wish everyone a Shana Tova. Parshat Nitzavim, which is found on page 880, is always read the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah. There's certain parshio throughout the year that are always read at a certain time in order to prepare us for the holidays. So certain parshio become doubled up in order that this actually takes place. I'm going to point out four main parts of this parsha. It's a very small one, but it has some key sentences in. The very first sentence is on 878, is Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. And this is an interesting sentence because what it really says, that although Matan Torah, the revelation, took place approximately 3,200 years ago, you are all standing today, men, women, old, young, people who are simple people, who chop wood, everyone is standing to accept the covenant of the Torah. So a lot of people feel that I don't have the chance to really be in the covenant because the covenant was given to my father and grandfather, and if I would be able to accept it, maybe I wouldn't accept it, or I didn't have the experience. And the main thing is to have the experience, says the Torah. When you read this before Rosh Hashanah, what you should get yourself into the mood is Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem, that you are standing today making a covenant with God. That the dialogue which existed in the time of Moses also exists with you as well. Therefore, the concept of time in Judaism, and time is a very difficult concept in philosophy. A lot of people have spent years and years and pages trying to understand what time is, starting from Aristotle all the way down to Henri Bergson. But basically it says that although there's a tremendous time gap between Moses and you, time is, so to say, put all together, and you stand together with the Jewish people and with Moses accepting the covenant. How many people feel that? Can anyone experience that for a moment? Yes, Donna. No. The exact time frame of when it actually took place, it happened more in Yom Kippur when he came down, but I don't recall right now. It's always been a little confusing and cloudy to me about that time frame. I know it was the second period of 40 days, but the main thing is to try to experience what the Torah is saying, is try to be in relationship with God. Not that you are a son or daughter accepting it from a father and mother, but you are accepting it. Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. That you're all accepting the covenant. That you are the first person to accept it for the next generation. And your next generation are your disciples, your friends, and your children, your associates. Whoever will be in contact with you should somehow know that you were at Mount Sinai. Talk louder, please.
Yeah, and that was announced in the book of Numbers already. So
So therefore, once he is passing, then we are standing. Right. Right. Thank you. Yes, Cindy. Which people are strangers? In which sentence? This word gerchar, according to the interpretation, are non-Israelites, people who accompanied the Jewish people out of Egypt. I don't know whether it refers to whether they ultimately converted or not, or they just went with the Jewish people. But there is a covenant. There are a few covenants in the Torah. Covenant number one is the covenant before Abram, with Noah. And as a result of that, you have the seven laws of Noah. And the covenant with Noah is the universal one with all of mankind. The second covenant is the one with Abraham, the Jewish people. And the third covenant is the one at Matan Torah. This is the third, a repetition of the third covenant. But the fact that it says V'gercha, yes, right. And it's sometimes, the question is, what does ger mean? Sometimes in some other places in the Torah, the word ger means ger toshav, which means the non-Jew who lives in Israel and obeys the seven laws of Noah. But definitely, this is more. This is more. Exactly. That's the meaning of it right here. That people, the word gercha here means if for some reason you are born into a certain faith and you want to partake of what was given beforehand, you need to be aware it seems that way. Yes. Well, one of the things, just to respond to you in a different way, one of the sentences that Hermann Hesse talks about a lot is that everyone has 100 souls, which means not that we have 100 souls, but there are 100 different aspects, at least, to every person's soul. So just like to every Jewish person, when he's part of the world, part of his soul is connected with other cultures and other religions. So it is with people in different faiths. Part of their soul is connected to the Jewish people. So I would like to look at it that way rather than the way you present it. Let me go on. So that's the first sentence, that you're in a relationship with God and you're standing together. There's no differentiation of socioeconomic status. It includes the person who chops wood and who draws water. All of them are in the covenant of God and the Torah. It's a pretty powerful beginning to begin Rosh Hashanah that way, to know that the covenant that you're in is your own covenant, and you have to make it your own covenant, which means you need to have what I call a personal relationship with God. And the person who emphasized that over and over again in the 20th century was Martin Buber. The necessity of having a personal relationship with God. And you once, and basically the axiom of this sentence, the underlying thesis of this sentence, is to develop that. How can you be atem nitzarim hayom kohem? How can you stand accepting the covenant unless you have a personal relationship with God? And therefore, what is necessary is really to develop that. It's a very difficult task. Turn the page now to 880. And in this sentence, we have now the following thing. Is part of this covenant is going to be difficult. Life is not easy. Much of life is a struggle. Most of life is a struggle, and as a result, you may be sent into exile. And that's going to happen. And the Jewish people, the history of the Jewish people is that they were sent into exile. But the question is, why were we sent into exile? And now we get to sentence 28. Diana Yeager, read that, sentence 28. This is one of the most famous sentences for people who are familiar with the Torah. I want to read it in Hebrew right now. Hanistorot, the secret things, Ladonai Eloheinu, are to God our God. Vahaniglos, and that which is revealed to us and to our children forever to do this entire Torah. Let me talk about the second part of the sentence first, and then we'll get back to the first part. So the second part of the sentence says, if you are sent into exile, it's because of the revealed things that you did not do properly. There were revealed things which you did not do properly, and the Beis Din and the Sanhedrin and the court system, their function was to teach what you should do, and it didn't take place, and they were not able to eliminate that part of the evil, and that's why you're sent into exile. So why are you sent into exile? Because of acts of omission or commission that you need to do something about. Like the sentence, Lo tamod al dam re'echa, if you see someone drowning, you have to do something about it. It's an act of omission by not doing so on and so forth. The first part of the sentence, Hanistarot Ladonai Eloheinu. And it's very interesting because in last week's class, we had difficulty with the word Nistarot, secret things. And it's like the Torah knew that the first time I introduced the concept of secret things, there would be difficulty because people don't like to hear it. So the Torah says, I'm going to repeat the concept again because I know people will not understand it the first time. So he says, the secret things, look at the words, Hanistarot, Ladonai Eloheinu, are to God, our God, which means you will not be sent into exile collectively as the Jewish people for things that are Nistarot. What is Nistarot? For the secret things in your mind, your thoughts, or secret sins which you do that no one else knows about, those things, when there is a collective punishment on the Jewish people, you should know it's never about private thoughts that are not very good. However, say all the Mefarshim, God will deal with you individually based on the Nistarot, but not collectively. Why do you think the Torah goes out of its way to teach us that? That the punishments that the Jewish people get collectively will never be based on secret things. Right. But why do you think it's repeating it? Why is it so important to know this? You have to take responsibility. But number two, what would most people think if there's a collective punishment, knowing that everyone in this room and everyone in the entire world always has Nistarot? which is known what I call universal secrets, which is the way we are created. People would be punished all the time, and you would feel, I can't do anything about it. Look, God is punishing me for the type of human being I am, which he created. So God is saying, I'm not that type of God. I will deal with you personally, individually, through dialogue and through transformation, understanding your vulnerabilities and weaknesses. I know how I created you with the constant struggle. So Hanistarot, Ladonai Eloheinu. You should never think that what you thought causes anything collective to happen to the family structure or to the community or to the Jewish people as a whole. One person interprets it differently. The Ramban. The Ramban says, Hanistarot Ladonai of Eloheinu refers to the thing that you have done things unconsciously, things in error, unintentionally and unconsciously, and you will not be punished for them. 10 other people refer to it as I first explained it, that you need to be responsible for your own mind, but God will deal with you individually, but never collectively. No. The first interpretation, which is the majority interpretation, you are responsible for your secrets. The second interpretation by the Ramban says you are not responsible for your secrets. And things that I didn't know that I occurred. But it also refers to private thoughts, like we talked about last week. Maybe you do behavior which is correct, but private thoughts which are incorrect. But the Ramban says, I will not deal with you on this. That's the Ramban. Everyone else says, you are responsible for this. Yes, Julie. Thank you for being so honest. And public confession, wow. What else you want to confess, Julie? That's the big one for this week. Does everyone remember what I asked? Oh, you thought it was... You put it off. What I said... Julie, tell everyone what I said to give it as an experiment. And did you fail very badly? And by the way, this type, now I'm not talking about Julie, I'm just talking in general. Frequently, sins that people do, I'm using the word sins intentionally, which is a religious term, is based very much upon personality theory. So for example, if someone is very narcissistic, then obviously they love talking about themselves. So to a great extent, this shows the relationship between religion and personality theory. And that needs to, for example, there are a lot of people who are very much in control because that's the way they deal with the pain that they don't want to express. And by being in control, they hurt other people and those things as well. But we'll deal with that in a moment or two, Julie. Yes, Hindi. Mm-hmm. So obviously, a struggle in reading. By the way, where does that say what Hindi is saying? It's a very powerful expression. A lot of people are unaware of it. In Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, it says you should do things mitoch shelo lishma balishma, even if you're not doing it authentically. There's value in doing it because it will lead in the right direction. So one of the thoughts I have in my mind is a word I was teaching of Nils Lune, the value of pious pretentiousness. So in graduate school, while I was a student, they teach a lot about what's known as authenticity and genuineness, and they have even a French word for bad faith. And, you know, that's a big thing in existential theory. But I don't think that's correct, and I don't think the religion teaches that. I think religion teaches a lot that you should act piously, even if it's pretentiously. One second. You understand the words? Piously means to act appropriately, even if it's pretentiously, even if you don't mean it, because mitok shelo lishma, things you do it, it will have an impact on your mind. Obviously, if you can do it with genuineness, ma tov u ma na'im, it's beautiful. But if you can't, then it's nice to do this, and hopefully it will have a positive impact. Yes, Barbara. Okay, I'll get back to you in a moment. Well, no, it's a good point what you said. In other words, what I said last week, I mean that, so I'm repeating it, is that if you have a lot of toxicity in your heart about doing a certain act, and if you do it, I'm convinced that the feeling in your heart will come across, and that is very painful. So I guess if it's neutral and the toxicity is not so much there, if you can feel the toxicity, it definitely should not be done. If it's a sense of privacy and you can be piously pretentious, have a pretty smile and things like that, and actually do it and create conversation, then it's something else. So it's a matter of degree and variation. Yes, Andy. Mm-hmm. One of my major talks that I plan for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is the topic of cognitive dissonance. And that is basically not an academic topic, but basically the question is, who are you? Are you what you do, what you think, what you say, the complexity of all, the conglomeration of all? All of the above, none of the above? It's a very difficult topic, but basically, it's not that, it's important what a person says, and it's important what a person thinks, and it's also important what a person does. And to the extent that they are in polarities and far apart, that's the extent of the pathology. To the extent that they're closer together, you're heading in the sense of what's known in Hebrew and in English, atonement, which means at one mint. The more you strive for that ultimate unity. Yes? Yeah, but Hindi, you were not here last week. You would have had an ally last week. I'm sorry Nathan isn't here.
Where's Nathan when you need him?
Nathan was a little vociferous last week. It's interesting, you're saying the same thing, but you're saying it so gently. That I agree with you, Hindi. I didn't agree with Nathan. But basically, let me tell you why I disagree with you, Hindi, okay? and I appreciate the way you said it, is that we are responsible for our thoughts on an individual basis, and the thoughts of people, I know they hurt me personally, and if it hurts me and if it hurts the people that I have helped, it's a universal thing. And I'd rather that, and to the extent that one is open to wounds, those are very, very powerful wounds. Oh, that's good. That's fine. That's fine. That's the same thing with Yaakov and Moshe, being aware of that and hopefully being in transformation, even in process. That's the best that we can hope for. Yeah, but what Jung said and what other people have said, we can't change human nature. This is who we are. But at least be conscious of it. That's what you're saying. At least to be conscious of the struggle is the major, major thing. Right. On the thought level.
On the thought level, could you
I think what God is saying here is as follows. Hanistarot Lashem Elkeinu, I created humanity with such a struggle and such a complexity that obviously you have to be responsible on an individual basis. But this is like the ultimate of life. Even says God in a different place, there are two parts to me. One part is my face, and the other part is called Hester Panim, which is the secrets of my face. The word Hester Panim in Hebrew refers to contradiction. So it's like God has two faces, and we have two faces. Hester Panim means contradiction, or in a Jungian term, it's a union of opposites. And if we can be aware of that, that's fantastic. But to the extent that we're unaware of that, then we cause a lot of pain to other individuals. And yourself as well. That's why it says, Hanistarot, listen carefully, Hanistarot, I created humanity with this type of thing. I know all about it, says God, but this is part of me. I have both a face and I have a Hester Panim. And this is the most difficult aspect of life, of God, and of people. And therefore, it's Lashem Elokeinu. We will deal with that individually. Let me go to the next topic. The next topic in chapter 30, all throughout the Torah, whenever a person did a major sin, what should they do? They should go to an Ir Miklat, a city of refuge, and it became like the Mizbeach, like the altar. And remember, you had to wait for the high priest to die, and then he would go free. In other words, wherever you would go, there would be like a temple. If you would be in exile, if you wear tefillin, and you have a mezuzah, and you learn Torah, it's like the temple. Your home becomes a temple. The tefillin becomes like the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and the learning of the Torah becomes like the actual service. There will be a time when you will be in exile, says the Torah, that you won't have anything to do with tefillin, you won't have anything to do with a mezuzah, you won't have anything to do with Torah, you will have experienced life in such a way that you don't want anything to do with God. There will be a time like that in everyone's life frequently. This is what the Torah says. Then comes something else in sentence 11 on page 881. Ki ha-mitzvah hazot, referring to the mitzvah of teshuvah, lo niflet hi v'lo rechoka hi. The mitzvah of teshuvah is not far away. It's not in the heaven and it's not over the seas. You just have to take that very, very first step. Teshuva is repentance. So teshuva is mentioned now at the end of the Torah to saying, you don't want to have a temple, and you've been away from the temple, and you've been away from tefillin and saying blessings and all the service, and you just don't understand it. You have to remember that as part of the covenant of being in dialogue with God, the door is always open, and that is called teshuvah, to return. And teshuvah basically means coming home again. The idea of coming home. Coming home is a sense of security, regardless of how life has been with me. There's always a place to go home to. And that is called teshuva. Yes, ma'am. It's not as simple as that. No, you're not looking for a place, right? Right. And that's why after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we go to a sukkah, the fragile hut, the home, because it's not the security of the walls or the bed or whatever you else have at home. It's a sense of recognizing how fragile life is and the struggle that I do want to go home. So what I'm saying to you, Donna, it's not simple just to be with God, because God has said that I have both a face and another face. And anyone who has experienced any part of life recognizes the two faces of God and the two faces of yourself. And then, turn to page 883. What should you do with this struggle that ultimately you're part of the covenant, you want to be with God, but you get sent to exile? The secret things about God and the secret things about yourself, says the Torah, and this is a very, very famous phrase on top of 883, Uvarchartar Bachayim. My suggestion, says the Torah, is to choose life. There are always two directions, always two paths. The struggle is always. And can you choose life? Uvachatra Bahayim. And what does life mean? Read the last sentence. Le Ahava et Adonai Elohecha, to love God. And you remember what the word love means based on the Shema, which means B'chol Levavcha, which means your two hearts, to love God with two hearts. To listen to his voice and to cleave unto him. So on and so forth. And so this parsha of Nitzavim has four main points. Point number one is that you are establishing the covenant with God. You will never be punished for your private thoughts. You will never be punished collectively for your private thoughts. Although you, on an individual basis, will have a relationship with God dealing with the private thoughts you have and the other face of God. No matter where you are in your life, the door of teshuvah is always open in a gradual way. And once you've opened that door, then uvarchatra b'chayim, then the suggestion of the Torah is to choose life. So basically, from the very beginning of the book of Genesis until the very end of Nitzavim, we are always presented with one main theme. And that is, what did God create on the first day? But energy. It took the form of light. He couldn't have created light because light was created on the fourth day. Why did he create positive energy? because the only thing that pre-existed creation was darkness. So you have darkness, and then he created Or, the famous eternal light, which is known in Kabbalistic terms as Or HaGanuz, the hidden mysterious life force of the world. And now at the end of the Torah, once again we are reminded of this bifurcation of one's existence, the two faces of God, our private thoughts and public deeds, and we're constantly aware of this struggle that hits us every day, and this is what it is, and the way to do what's known as Tikkun HaOlam is to do Uver Harta B'Chayim, to choose life. Is it easy? Absolutely not. Is it a struggle? Absolutely. Is it continuous? Absolutely. Do you go up a hill and down a hill? Absolutely. And that's what it is, the cycle of life. No, it doesn't mean that we don't have a problem. Even no matter what free will one has, it's the basic aspect of life remains the same. However, it's interesting, the book that addresses this problem the most, both aspects, obviously, is the book of... Which book in the Bible? Say it. The book of Job. And Job gives a rather interesting response to this dichotomy. Job's response to this dichotomy is... Does anyone know the book of Job well? Basically, what he says is as follows, is to be able to experience God not only in the sense of immanence, but also in the sense of transcendence. Immanence means a personal God. You weigh a scale, the good and the bad. And transcendence means you experience God in totality, that you see the marvels of the world, and you look at a bird, that it can fly, and you look under a microscope, and you see what you see, all of that, that is a transcendent view of God. Once you have a transcendent view of God, and that's the path of individuation that Job took, going from immanence to transcendence, that is a form of Uver Harta B'Chayim. It's extremely difficult to do. It's almost asking yourself to be aware of the immanence, but to strive for the transcendence. It's extremely difficult to do. Immanence is a personal God, and transcendence is almost metaphysical, beyond the personal. And once you see the total mystery of the creation of the world and you're engaged in that journey, then whatever happens, as painful as it is, it's seen in the perspective of transcendence. The problem is, going back to personality theory, the more narcissistic people are, the more difficult it is to develop a feeling of transcendence. And everyone has a touch of narcissism.
Because otherwise you'll get your holiness.
Otherwise you'll get what?
Mm-hmm. Almost like God. Mm-hmm.
And it's dangerous also. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's not only to trend. Right. It's very hard to do. They help one another. No. God is your personal God, and God is also the God of everything. No, it's the integration of both. There was a philosopher, that I know you don't know this man, his name is Ephrat, E-F-R-O-S, and his whole thesis was to really develop a religious personality, is the integration of immanence and transcendence. And it's very hard to do that. That's really the journey of life. Most people are involved with an immanent God. Great poets are involved with the integration. Like, for example, William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, to be able to put both together. Auguries of Innocence, to look at a grain of sand and see the entire world in a grain of sand. That's really the task of life. Because once you're there, you get to an altered state of consciousness, and then your immanence is not as toxic. That's the reason. Two faces, just in terms of nomenclature, of what that's the way humans talk, and that's the way we experience it. But it's ultimately, it's all one. Ultimately, what Dr. Leeds is saying is correct. We're only talking this way because this is our language. But ultimately, it's all one. And that's why the last prayer a Jewish person says, is the Shema, which ends with the word Echad. And it's like when you die, you're supposed to, if you're conscious, obviously, not if you're in a coma. But, you know, many people, when they're sick, they're not able to do this, but you're supposed to say the word Echad in a long way, and then by saying it in a long way, you take your last breath that way, and it's like one. Your life here and your life there and God and everything, it's all one. Why does the concept of one or unity, why is that such an important thing? It's a very, very difficult question, that. It's not an easy question. It's so difficult, I can't say it again. You know, we all say life will, Dr. Leeds said, I said, other people said, well, it's all one, two faces, and it's all one. It's belief in monotheism, it's all one, and life and death and after, it's all one. Well, why does that make anyone feel better? What difference does it make? It's all the same problems, right? Absolutely. Right. It's all one. Even what? Even God. So, for example, the rabbis say an interesting sentence that when we go into galut, into exile, who else is in exile? God. So it's all one. This is the reality of the world. Like the word integrity, which is honesty and things like that, comes from the word integer, which means one. That somehow, if it's all one, we say, this is the reality. What can we do? This is what it is.
Because
interesting then, that book, The Celestine Prophecy, that some of you have read and some of you will be reading. Thank you for laughing. That was a joke. I try so hard. Talks about everything is energy. Everything is energy. Even matter. One's human existence is energy. And that's the all different forms of energy. And that is why the sentence, Uva heart of Ahayim, you shall choose life, is the same thing that God did on the first day. He created light. Positive energy. Hindi and then Dandi. Dust is what